about where we are. We need, so before the break I said, given a choice between earnings and cash flows, go with the cash flow. Two more pieces I want to add to that. You want your cash flows to be incremental cash flows. The moment is going to sound mysterious, but when you look at an investment, the only cash flows you should really be looking at are the cash flows created by that investment. Okay, and I'll come back and give you examples. Okay. And finally, you want the cash flows to be time weighted. Have you ever seen one of those old corporate finance books? I don't think it's in my book, but the old books, there used to be a present value table at the end of the book, where it told you what a dollar was worth in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Take a look at that. It says a dollar in 1 year is worth 91 cents, in 2 years is worth 82. That's a time weight. That's what discounting is. It's time weighting the cash flows. A good measure of return is a time weighted incremental cash flow return. Okay? File that away. Because here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to create a hypothetical project for Disney. And for the next hour, I'll do the number crunching. You have a singular objective. You're going to make the decision on whether Disney should open this or take this project or not. So let me start by describing the project. How many people here have never been to a Disney theme park? Maybe you should want to make one of those Super Bowl commercials. Have you seen these? You finished the Triumph training program. What are you going to do? I'm going to go to Disneyland. But even if you've never been at a Disney theme park, you kind of know what it looks like, right? Every Disney theme park has a Magic Kingdom. And every Magic Kingdom in the foreground has a castle. A fake castle, but that goes without saying, it's Disney. You walk through the castle and you're the happiest place on earth. That's the way Disney, it's filled with screaming kids being dragged around by parents, but it's the happiest place on earth. So here's what my new investment is going to be. It's going to be a set of two theme parks that Disney is planning to build in Rio de Janeiro. This is going to add to the excitement of going to theme park is to put it in Rio. This way you don't know whether you'll make it out of the theme park when you go in, so add to the risk of the process. So the first theme park is going to be a Magic Kingdom. It's going to take a year to build and be open for operations at the start of the second year. Your second theme park is going to be a variation on Epcot. Have you guys ever been to Epcot? I think it's one of the scariest places on the face of the earth. First, there's a lake. And around the lake is the world as Disney sees it. So you got, usually the way the world Disney sees it is there's a pavilion for the country and there's a restaurant for each country. I remember the first time I went around Epcot, I noticed something very significant. They miss a few countries. You don't think, you miss Albania. I can see that. But you know who else they miss? There is no India. How do you miss a billion people? That's the only thing I thought about. But the Epcot is that second theme. So the second theme park is going to take a lot longer to build because you've got to build an artificial lake in Rio and surround it with the world. So that's going to take the second and the third year and be open for operations at the start of the fourth year. So remember, your job is to tell me whether to open these theme parks. I'm going to cheat and give you all the cash flows in US dollars. Why is that cheating? Because if it's in Rio, the cash flows are actually going to be in reais. I'm going to assume that for the moment you're not ready to deal with reais, so I'm going to give it to you in dollars. So I'm the number cruncher. I'm going to project out the cash flows on these theme parks. So think of my task. I have the tough job, right? I go to my desk, I sit down in front of a spreadsheet, it's empty. I've got to start populating the spreadsheet. So where do I start doing the work that allows me to project out the revenues and expenses and earnings and cash flows of these two theme parks? What am I going to do? I know I need visitors, but how am I going to come up with the numbers? What am I going to look at? I'm going to look at my history. I'm going to look at Euro Disney. I'm going to look at Hong Kong Disney. I'm not saying every theme park is a replica of another, but that's a logical place to start. And that's where I went. I found the numbers for Euro Disney. I found the numbers for Tokyo Disney. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make some assumptions about how much the theme park is going to cost me. Disney has already spent $500 million lining up stuff for this theme park. And this money is gone. So if you decide not to invest in this theme park, you're not going to get it back. We'll come back and talk about how that matters. $500 million has already been spent. Magic Kingdom is going to cost $3 billion. $2 billion up front and $1 billion at the end of the first year, so that's kind of a spread out cost. Epcot is going to cost $1.5 billion. $1 billion in year two and $500 million. So you can see for the next 3 years, you have investments coming in that are going to cost you money. All of these investments are going to be treated as capital expenses and depreciated according to depreciation schedule. So here's the first thing I did. I project out the accounting earnings on the theme park. I know I've kind of been mean about accountants, but let me start with accounting earnings. So I built up the revenues for each of the theme parks. Year zero is really not a year, it's a point in time, right now. So I have nothing happening. Year one, I have no revenues. How come? I'm building the theme park. Though if I'd been creative, I could have charged people to come in and watch construction, right? But I didn't think of that. Year two, Magic Kingdom kicks in. It's ready to go. So year four, Epcot kicks in. So the collective revenues of the theme parks are in those first two lines. Then there's a third line that says resort properties. You know what those are? Disney World, if you go to Orlando, around the theme park are all these hotels that Disney has built. They're leech properties. Leech properties in what sense? You'd be out of your mind to go spend a week at the Dolphin unless you're going to a Disney theme park. So here's what I did. I looked at Orlando and looked to see how much revenues Disney made at those hotels as a percentage of the revenues in the theme parks. As a general practice, when you're building these models, it's always a good idea to tie them to something central. To me, the central number is how many people are showing up in the theme park, and for every dollar in the theme parks, I get 25 cents in revenues, and that's my revenues from the resorts. I add the three numbers up, I come up with the total revenues from the theme parks. Everybody with me so far? These are estimates. Could I be wrong? Absolutely. Does that bother me? No. Why? Because I have to make estimates. I'm always going to be wrong. Yeah.
Do you adjust for population and income?
I have to. Basically, you have to bring in on population. You got to bring in income level. The question is, how will that show up? Maybe the ticket prices in Rio will be lower than they are now. Incidentally, that's not been the case with Disney theme parks around the world. Hong Kong Disney is no cheaper than going to Euro. So I'm not sure I can get away with, I can't let people arbitrage. Or, you know, Disney World and Rio Disney. But I have to factor those in. And remember, if I build a theme park in Rio, I'm not just going after Brazilian visitors. Essentially, it's a Latin America base. That's where I'm drawing people from. But you're right, I have to look at the demand, I have to look at the potential market. And all of those things should also be going in, kind of nudging my numbers. So I got my revenues. What's the next step? I have to estimate my expenses. I started off estimating my direct expenses of running the theme parks. These are all the people you see in the theme park cleaning up after you, maintaining the theme park. And I set those at 60% of the revenues at the theme park. You're saying, why 60%? Because that's what it is at the other theme parks right now. Again, could it be different in Rio? Absolutely. And for the resort properties, I set the expenses at 75% of revenues because, again, that's what they're making on their resort properties right now. So I've got my expenses for running the theme parks and running the hotels. And then I have two accounting expenses I'm going to bring in. The first is depreciation and amortization. Why is it showing up? Because in the first year, I'm acting like I'm spending nothing, right? If you look at year zero and one, but the reality, I'm spending these huge amounts that I'm spreading out over time, and the accounting depreciation captures that. And right below that is an item that says allocated G&A. If any of you work at big companies, this is a bogeyman that you can never get away from. What the heck is allocated G&A? I know it's general and administrative costs, so let's not spread. But what exactly goes in it?
These are the CEO salaries.
If any of you work at big companies, do you notice there are big parts of the company where you say, what do those guys do? Entire sections of the company where lots of people go into buildings and come out, but nothing ever emerges of that. I won't name which buildings these are. But these are cost centers. I'm being kind. Cost centers. Including the CEO. No CEO ever creates revenues. And that drives accountants crazy. So you know what? They gather all these cost centers together. They call it G&A, and then they go look for a place to attach the expense. Oh, you look like you're making a lot of revenues. Would you like $1 billion in expense? You said, no, please keep it. No, sorry. This is part of the corporate family. You get $1 billion in G&A. So this is Disney's G&A expenses, most of which have nothing to do with this project. So why are they attaching it to you? Because you look like you have revenues. So the G&A is actually that allocation of the project because it looks like it's going to make revenues. I'm almost there. So I take the revenues, I subtract out the direct expenses, I subtract out depreciation, I subtract out allocated G&A. I come up with my estimate of the operating income on this theme park. And in year one, no surprise, I'm losing money. Year two, no surprise, I'm still losing money. It's not until year four that my accountant will tell me that I've broken even. That's my operating income. And then I have to factor in taxes, right? Because if I take the project, I have to pay taxes. In year one, I do something very strange. I have a $50 million loss and I have a negative tax. So what exactly am I assuming I'm going to be able to do in year one? Because there are two things you can do with taxes. One is carry them forward. The other is? If you're a big company that loses money on a project, what's the most sensible thing to do? Claim it against your other income. So I'm assuming in year one and two that my losses are going to be offset against other income and that I save taxes right away. Are you always going to be able to do it? Maybe not. If this is a standalone project, I might have to carry the losses forward till I make money. Here I'm assuming a tax benefit right away. See the bottom line? That's my after-tax operating income. Couple of things I want to add about this. One is that allocated G&A that you saw. Two-thirds of the G&A have nothing to do with this project. It's Bob Iger's bonus. And guess what? He's not going to take a lesser bonus if you reject this project. File that away. We're going to come back and deal with it. Accountants don't care about it, but we might in decision-making. And the tax rate is based on the 36.1%. You ready? You're the decision-maker. I come and put the sheet of paper in front of you. What's your job? To tell me whether to open this theme park. Can you make a decision based on this page? Hey, come on, don't be greedy. You're going to make $421 million in year 10. Isn't that a lot of money? You haven't scaled it to something, right? By itself, dollar profits are not enough. At least even in accounting basis, you want to scale it to what you invest in the project. And if you let accountants define investment, what are they going to come up with? Book value, right? Basically what you've invested. So here's what I did. I took the after-tax operating income from this page. I looked at that CapEx, because that's what book value is. I kept track of the book value each year, and I divided the after-tax operating income. In my book value, I include both working capital and this theme park. And I divided the after-tax operating income by the book value of capital to come up with a return on capital. Now we're starting to get to a number you could use. Of course, that number is negative upfront because I'm losing money. But across the 10 years, this project looks like it's going to make about 4.1% to 4.2% as a return. So remember, you're the decision maker. Now I've converted the dollar operating income into a return on capital. To use this, you've got to compare it to what you need to make, right? So let me give you some choices. If you think about what I can compare the 4.12% to, you can compare to the risk-free rate that you had, which would be 2. Why not? Why are you guys getting greedy? Because it's not risk-free, right? So the question is, what do you compare it to? Let me give you the other choice. You had the cost of capital for Disney as a company, which was 7.81%. Can I compare it to that? What about the cost of capital for Disney theme parks? Remember, I computed that as well. Let me go back to that page. The cost of capital for Disney theme parks was, I think, 6.61%. Can I compare it to that? I'm getting a little closer, but there's one small problem. That 6.61% is the cost of capital for Disney's existing theme parks, which are in Anaheim, Orlando, Paris, and Tokyo. Remember, Hong Kong hadn't even opened. And this theme park is in? Rio. Now do you see the question you have to face? 6.61% is the cost of capital of the business you're in. This project, though, is in Brazil. I've got to bring it in here. I can't wait for later in the process. And luckily, we've set up a structure to do this. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm doing everything in US dollars still, so my risk-free rate is still 2.75%. It's still a theme park investment. That hasn't changed, so I leave the beta at the 0.7537 that I estimated before. All I do is I change the risk premium I had from the 5.5% I was using before, the 5.76%, with the risk premium for Brazil. How did I get that? same way we talked about this yesterday. Start with a mature market premium. What that does is pushes up my cost of equity and my cost of capital. So rather than compare my return on capital to 6.61%, I'd compare it to 8.5%. This is the template that I use with multi-business companies when they're thinking about projects. Is not only do I factor in what business the project is in, I factor in through the risk premium where the investment is going to be made.
Are you using the same debt to equity ratio?
That's a question to ask. I'm using the debt to equity ratio I computed for the theme park business. And the question you had to ask is, maybe because it's in Brazil, maybe you want to consider a different debt ratio. That's fine.
Maybe you want to use more leverage to...
I don't know, I might want to use less leverage. You know why? You're in a risky country. The last thing I want to do is take the fixed cost, add debt on it. So it can cut both ways. So if you choose to do it, that's fine. You can actually change the weights, but then make sure you change the levered beta and the debt to equity and the debt to capital. But make sure you factor in the business. And the. So you're ready to make the decision? What did I say the return on capital on this theme park was? 4.11. What do you need to make?
9.16.
No, actually 8.46%. You're ready to say no, right? I'm going to hold you back. And one reason I want to hold you back is to compute that 4.11% return on capital, I projected the earnings for the next 10 years, right? In fact, half of all capital budgeting and valuation analyses in the U.S. use a 10-year life. Why? What happens magically after 10 years? Why do we use 10-year lives? Why not 9? Why not 11? Why not 7? Why not 15? I'm sorry? But why 10?
It hasn't always done like that.
Again, I'll give you my reasoning. It is what fits comfortably going landscape in Excel on one page. You think that's absurd. There's no good reason. You think, so what? Let me go back and show you the 4.11 and you tell me whether you see a pattern in the numbers. As I go through time, what's happening in the numbers? They're getting higher and higher. So by stopping after 10 years, I am making an effect on the average. If I'd gone to 15, you're saying that's always going to be true. But in this case, I have to be particularly careful because I do have some lab experiments that are already on the ground that are giving me information about how long theme parks last. How old is Disneyland? I've seen the 50th anniversary commercial now for at least 8 years. So if you had 50 plus 8, 58 years, and it's making more money for Disney now than it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and definitely more money than the first 10 years. Disney World is 35 years old, actually 45 years old, right? 1971. It makes more money for Disney now than it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or in the first 10 years. I don't know whether any of you are old enough to remember all those horror stories that came out about Euro Disney when it first opened, which were absurdly stupid because Euro Disney actually was doing better in its first 10 years than Disney World and Disneyland were. But if you take any theme park, the first 10 years are in a sense your worst 10 years. It's like any infrastructure investment. And what am I doing? I'm killing your project just as it becomes a cash cow. Yeah.
I mean, nobody after 10 years will do that. Reinvest.
Yeah, that's fine. Just so you can talk about what you need to reinvest, but I'm killing the project here. Basically, we're not even talking about growth and reinvestment. We're saying everything ends after 10 years. And not surprisingly, if I run a theme park for only 10 years, the answer is don't invest in the theme park. Now, what's a common sense solution? Just go past 10 years. Now, do you see why with accounting earnings this causes trauma? Because to go past 10 years, I have to project revenues and expenses and revenues and expenses. It's very difficult with accounting earnings to make your life longer without putting yourself to pain. With cash flows, I'm going to give you a very simple trick for going past 10 years with very little pain. And I'll come to that. So at least at this stage in the process, you have some numbers. They don't look that good, but you shouldn't be ready to kill the project yet. Now I'm going to take a little tangent. When I look at the accounting return on capital on a project, and I compare it to the cost of capital, I'm asking, is this a good project, right? But remember when we looked at a company, I broke down its assets into assets in place and growth assets. In other words, when I look at Disney today, it's already made these projects in investments over the last 50 years, 100 years. Before I get too ambitious about the future, shouldn't I stop and ask, are its existing investments good investments? You see why this matters? If you have a company with a history of taking bad investments, you should be a lot more skeptical when I come and say, I found a great investment, than if I have a history of taking good investments. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to take Disney as a company. I'm going to take the operating income that Disney earns as a company. And right now, after taxes, Disney makes $6.92 billion. And I'm going to try to divide that by what capital Disney has invested in its existing projects. And this is going to be a bit of a nightmare, because those projects were taken 50, 60, 70 years ago. I'm kind of stuck with what the accountant tells me. And this is the only place in finance where we use book values. We're using book values because I have no other choice. If I take the book value of debt plus book value of equity minus cash, I get a number called invested capital. It's a measure of what the accountant tells me is invested in the company. And for Disney, that number is 54.9 billion. If I divide the after-tax operating income by that book value of capital, I come up with a return on capital for Disney of 12.61%. So all the normal caveats apply. It's an accounting number, trusted only as far as you can throw it. But to the degree that I trust that number, what is it telling me? Collectively on its existing projects, Disney is making 12.81%. Or 12.6%. What does it need to make? The overall cost of capital for the company is 7.8%. Take the difference between those two numbers. It looks like Disney collectively is making about 5% or 4.8% more than its cost of capital. Why? When you look at excess returns, where do they come from? Comparative advantages, barriers to entry. What's Disney's biggest comparative advantage? Mickey. More Mickey, right? I mean, it's basically the decades of brainwashing children. I mean, in a nice way. That's fine. That's so at least in this table, Disney looks like it has generated more. Daniel?
Those book values adjusted by inflation.
That's one of the problems. In fact, the older assets, they're not in most parts of the world. And if they're not, older assets are always going to look better than newer assets. So older a company comes. It comes, in fact, that's the least of your problems. You know what else it's affected by? When you take a really bad investment as a company and the accountant finally lets you recognize it's a bad investment, what do accountants do? They write it off. That really worries me more than the inflation. You see why? Because you keep writing off your mistakes. When I look at a return on capital, I say, you're a great company. I mean, HP has written off $16 billion worth of mistakes over the last 6 years. I want you to leave your mistakes on your books. I'm against this writing off stuff. Because I want to see how stupid you've been historically and make sure that you're not continuing that brand of stupidity.
Couldn't you do that by using historical costs?
You could, but how are you going to get it? Do you see what see, all you have is balance, so you'd have to actually get 50 years of income statements. Look, so you'd actually have to have you'd have to go back in time and look at the restructuring charges and the write-off charges over time. Could you do it? Yes, on one company you could.
Don't you but have historical costs in the notes for U.S. companies?
No. Not what was originally paid. No. That's way back in time. So basically, you will not get that. You could, over time. So there are ways you can try to work yourself back. Do any of you have sleep trouble, trouble falling asleep? I have a solution. I have a paper I wrote 6 years ago, which is perhaps the most boring thing. I fell asleep while I was writing this paper multiple times. It was how to get the return. It's basically this very simple question. How do I get the return on capital for a company? It's four numbers, right? And all the things I had to clean up for. These write-offs, you know, goodwill creates messes all over the place. Acquisition charges. And I talked about how you get it right, and it took 72 pages for me to get to the answer. It gives you some sense of how much trouble. But it's, if you were, but I'll also give you the best case scenario, which is it's a snapshot. It's a very flawed snapshot, but at least it gives you a sense of where the company is. Remember yesterday I said 55% of all companies globally right now earn less than the cost of capital. This is what I do for every company in my sample. Every one of the 41,889 companies in my sample, I compute return on capital and I compute cost of capital. I do this difference. Are they flawed numbers? Yes. But you know what? I think the overall statistics tell the story. It could be 58, it could be 52. It's not 31, it's not 79. So it's a very quick and dirty way of thinking about business. If you're a multi-business company, this can be your moment of reckoning. You see what? If I do a return on capital and cost of capital by business for Disney, and I find that they're earning less than the cost of capital in their movie business, and they're earning more than their cost of capital in the broadcasting business. Hey, that's a message I should be listening to as a multi-business company about where I should be investing and where I should be taking money away from. So if you're a multi-business, multinational company, start thinking about how you would have this pad, because it is something that you need as a manager, because we feed bad businesses with money from good businesses, and we continue to do this unless somebody stops and says, hey, this is crazy. Right? Yeah.
Sometimes for big companies,
right,
this is not taken into consideration, this example. They need numbers to cover what we get overhead or G&A, or because it's, if you look at the table here, 50% or 20% from the revenue.
No, this is after G&A and all those expenses, operating income, right?
No, when you take the numbers, we do, it's, yeah. Is the
are we talking about the project, or are we talking about this number?
No, we're talking about the project.
It's right.
11%.
Oh, you're saying that's why the allocated G&A is. That's the rationale for letting accountants do it, is they're trying to say every project has to cover other costs. So,
yes.
No, yeah. So for the moment, I'm letting them have their say, right? So that's fine. I've lowered the earnings to reflect it.
Yeah, but the earning is normally more than what we are seeing.
That's right. So
we need a special amount to cover our organization.
No, but that's what we're building in, right? Because our earnings after the allocation has to be high enough to get this 8.46% return.
No, what I'm saying, right. The G&A is, I'm sure it's not true what we're putting here. It should be less than this.
Oh, I agree.
It should be less, so the
so we come back to that. That's the incremental part. That's what we're going to ask later in this process. The accountant is going to allocate the G&A. Then I'm going to let you ask the question, is that fair?
Yes.
I mean, and you're absolutely right. We'll come back to that, because I shouldn't be subtracting out all this allocated G&A, because this project is not the one responsible for it, right?
Yes, but this is what we do. Because when we manage different companies,
right,
sometimes we hide numbers from its...
You can do whatever you want from an accounting perspective, but when it comes to decision making,
yes,
you need honest numbers. Right.
Each CEO, he knows exactly.
No, don't say he knows. By the time these numbers reach the CEO, he actually doesn't. That's part of the problem. Is by the time this goes, especially in large companies, you know how many layers these things go through? In each layer, you keep adding stuff, and by the time it gets to the top, it bears no resemblance to what this project actually delivers. And that's one of the points I'm going to make, is we need a process where it makes it easier for the decision maker to see what was added at each layer. Because I've seen numbers get to the top level, and you look at them and say, this is the most incredible amount of stuff that I've picked up along the way. Okay? Because in each part of the business, you've stopped and added things because that part wanted to put that. So we'll talk about how to clean up. But I think your point is a good one, which is it's an accounting earnings, but it doesn't reflect the true earnings of this project. It's not even close, and we need to clean it up for that. Yes?
Just to check with that, the return on capital here says tells us something about entire history of the company, does it?
Yes, it gives you exactly. Entire history as it stands today, right? So Disney could have been a great company 30 years ago. Now it's earning 4.8%. And in fact, if you look across the businesses, you notice that Disney, Vale, and Baidu all earned above the return cost of capital. If I looked at Vale in 2015, Vale's dropped off the top. And part of the reason, and if you ask Vale's CFO, who's my old student, you know what his reason is going to be, which is it's not our fault. Iron ore prices have gone from 100 to 35. And he has a point. Which means that if you look at commodity companies, any individual year might not look that good, but over time, over the cycle, you better earn more than your cost of capital. Yeah.
I just want to add to Omar's point, because I think I know what he knows, that managers are less sensitive in the initial stages of, let's say, a fiscal year,
right,
on calculating the cost of capital. They just want to generate revenue above their
expense.
To cover a certain.
See, that's kind of a minimalist. We're not even talking about. We're not even get to that stage though.
So, you know, maybe halfway through the. No, but wait.
Before we even get to that stage, we have to decide whether to take the project, right?
Yes,
so let's do that first, and then of course you can have all kinds of game playing go on after that, but the first stage has to be done right. And that's what I'm trying to move back towards is, can we make a good decision first, and then think about all the consequences of how this is going to play out. But you're right, once the business gets started, there are other factors that are going to come into play. I have to cover my expenses, I have to report a profit, now I have to cover the G&A. All that stuff can happen, but I still want to make sure that the upfront decision I made to build this theme park was a decision, because that was a big decision, right? Because once I make the decision, the pathway is laid for a whole bunch of expenses for the next decade, and I want to make sure that decision was okay. So this is actually kind of a snapshot. You can use it. And in fact, about 20 years ago, this consulting firm in New York called Stern Stewart, not only consulting firms are great at selling acronyms, decided that they were going to come up with this new way of managing companies called economic value added. I'm going to tell you what economic value added is, and at the end of my description, you tell me whether you see anything new or unique here. They took the difference between return on capital and cost of capital, which is what I computed on the previous page, which had nothing to do with Stern Stewart, and they added one layer to it. They multiplied it by how much capital they had invested. So what are they doing? They're taking a percentage number, and they're making it into a dollar value. And here's a remarkable insight they delivered. It's good to earn more than your cost of capital. And it's even better if you can earn more than your cost of capital on a lot of money rather than very little money. And CEO said, this is amazing. How the heck do you come up with insights like this? Here's $500,000. It's amazing what we pay for. Like the obvious restated. Much of corporate finance is old stuff repackaged and delivered in different ways, right? Whether it's CFR or Y that you compare to the EBA, it's, you take a look and step back and look at what's being done, essentially asking, am I making more than my cost of capital? So at this stage, I wouldn't blame you if you said, look, I don't have enough information. You're giving me accounting earnings, but you've already said earnings don't matter. We want cash flows, okay? So, if you get a chance, try computing the return cap for your company, because it's not, you know, if you look at the last page, I've given you the EBIT and the book value. So it's actually a very simple computation. Don't be surprised if you get an astonishingly high number for an Apple. Apple's return cap is about 35%. Or an astonishingly low number for GM. Yeah. It's the nature of the beast. Some companies earn more than their cost of capital, others earn less. But you constantly have to try. Yes,
some companies, they report in U.S. the return on...
Never trust a ratio computed by a company. This is something I've discovered. Partly because they have their own agenda. What they net out is God only knows what. They said, we can do this ourselves. So whenever a company says, I'll do it for you, I said, please, I can do it myself. Because I get to pick what I want in there, what I don't want in there. It's, again, try it for a company and you'd be amazed at how quickly you would start learning to do this whenever you look at a new company. So I want to get from earnings to cash flows. What are the three things I need to do to get from earnings to cash flows? I need to add back depreciation and amortization. Why? Because it's an accounting expense. I need to subtract out CapEx. Why? Because it's a cash outflow. And I need to subtract change in working capital to go from accrual earnings to cash earnings. And that's basically what I did. And there's something here that puzzles a few people. Remember I subtracted our depreciation to get to operating income? And now I'm adding it back? This seems like a waste of time. So I've seen analysts actually say, let me skip a step. I'll use EBITDA. I said, ignore this, you're subtracting and adding it back, this seems like a waste. But it's really not, right? Because even though I subtract our depreciation, add it back, it leaves an imprint on my cash flows in the form of a tax saving. That's the reason we care about depreciation, because it saves you taxes. See this bottom line here? This is getting closer to a truer picture of this project. You have negative cash flows up front. You shouldn't be surprised. That's exactly what you should see in a big infrastructure investment. The cash flows turn positive in year four, and then they start to pick up. Earnings to cash flows. Try this. Yeah, go ahead.
So the tax is the only reason why you don't go to the cash flows from the
Exactly, right? In fact, if you did not, if you don't pay taxes, don't waste your time doing depreciation. It means nothing. Depreciation matters only because it saves you taxes. Now, I want to go to incremental cash flows. You say, what the heck does that even mean? First, that $2.5 billion that I have in year one includes $500 million that I've already spent. I'm not going to get it back if I reject this project. What do we call that in finance? And what is it, what's every finance book, what does it say? Ignore sunk costs. And I'll say the same thing, but I'll also tell you, it is the most difficult thing for a human being to do. You spend 25 minutes in line. You know what you do? You wait in line. Why? Because you've already spent 25 minutes 2 hours later. You spent 2 hours in line. You feel even more. I have to. I've spent 20. We do this all the time. You lose $200 in a casino. What's your rational side saying? Leave. Leave right now. But then the other side says, as soon as I make my $200 back. This is how Jerome Kerviel could lose $6 billion. Or 6 billion euros, who's counting? Or 6 billion pounds. Nobody sits and says, I'm going to lose 6 billion today. So what he probably did was he lost 100 million. And guess what he tried to do? He wanted to make the 100 million back. Next thing you know, he's down 300 million. This is how you get gigantic losses. So I'll tell you the normal thing. Ignore sunk costs, but I'll also tell you psychologically, it's really difficult to do.
Sometimes politically as well.
Everywhere. In fact, I wrote this article about this baseball player called Alex Rodriguez. It's a third baseman for the New York Yankees, who has signed on a 10-year contract for $250 million in 2009. By 2013, he had all kinds of problems. You know, he had been taking, you know, so problems in terms of he's not hitting anymore. Anybody who looked at him as a baseball player, you know, from the outside, it's time to cut him loose. But I wrote an article, this is on my blog, I said, it's not going to happen. Why? Because the guy who signed him in 2009, Brian Cashman, is still the manager of the Yankees now. You think, so what? If he cuts him loose, what is he saying? I made a mistake. In fact, in behavioral finance, one of the most enduring findings is we hate selling losers in our portfolio. You know what I mean? You pick a stock, it goes down 80%. You know what we tend to do? We try to cover up with our hand. I don't see it. I don't think I invested in it. Because the very act of selling is an admission that you screwed up. So here I'm going to assume that you can get over all those psychological problems and say you shouldn't have subtracted that $500 million and look at only the $2 billion that's incremental. So that's the first step. The second, what did I say about the G&A? Two-thirds of it has nothing to do with the project, right? This is the incremental effect. One very simple way to answer the question is something incremental is to ask two questions. What will happen if I take the project? What will happen if I don't take the project? And if your answer is the same to both questions, it's not incremental. So let me ask you a question. What will happen if I take the project? Two-thirds of the G&A will get allocated to me, right? The two-thirds that comes from someone. What happens if I don't take the project? That two-thirds will just go somewhere else in the company. This is not incremental. So what I do is I add back that allocated G&A that I subtracted. I'm saying, I screwed up. I shouldn't have subtracted this out. This has nothing to do with the project. What I'm doing is I'm going from cash flows to incremental cash flows. So let's see the sequence. We started with the earnings. We went to cash flows to incremental cash flows. What's the last thing I need to do? Basically, that I subtracted out this G&A, right? Yeah. Two-thirds of the G&A have nothing to do with the project. So they're going to be there no matter what. They're Bob Iger's bonus, just allocated to your project. So if you don't take this project, guess where they're going to go? They're going to go to some other project. Disney as a company is not going to save this G&A if I don't take the project. So I'm going to add it back saying I should not have subtracted it out. I'll give you a very simple story to bring home, this notion of incremental. About 10 years ago, I was doing a training program for an investment bank. And I used to do a lot of these in the summer, for the money, mostly. And my July and August used to be training program, basically mostly July. I used to take 1 month and say, this is the month that I'm going to hold my nose, whole month. So I'd start on July 5th, and go all the way through July 30th. Or 31st, 31 days in July, yes. Now I'm going to go to the end of the month program. And after a while, I'd have no idea which investment bank I was in or what I was talking. I was an autopilot. I'd done so well that I could just go talk like a robot. And this was at a, you know, uptown hotel somewhere. I think it might have been a Merrill Lynch thing. It was July 29th to 30th. I was getting to the end of my tether. So I was checked out, but I was talking anyway. And there were these 300 people in the room who were all checked out as well. But the most attentive person in the room was actually the guy who was doing the catering. He was setting up the stuff. He listened to every moment, everything I was saying. The end of the second day, he comes to me and says, I have a question. I said, good, somebody has a question. So what's your question? He says, I'm from Guatemala. And every year when I go back home, it costs me about $1,000 round trip to go back. I go to the Gap or the Limit and I buy seconds. These are clothes with, you know, little damage in them. And I buy them for like $600 and I sell them for like $800. And all my accountant friends are telling me I should stop doing this. See how the accounting mindset works, right? Expenses $1,000, you make $200 in the business, that's an $800 loss. Stop doing it. He said, but I feel like I should keep doing this. So I asked him the question, which is,
will you go anywhere?
And he said, of course, my entire family is back there. Which means that if you listen to your accounting friends, next year what's going to happen? You're going to spend the $1,000 round trip. But instead of offsetting it with the $200 you used to make, now you spend the entire... This is why you shouldn't listen to your accounting friends. I've seen businesses be shut down because they're making accounting losses. I saw a major investment bank in the U.S. shut down its Asian operations in the late 90s during that crisis because they said it was losing money. You know why it was losing money? All these allocated expenses to it. Why? Anytime you ate at a Chinese restaurant, you're an investment bank, you said, that's Asian, it's charged to Asian equities. People were charging things to Asian equities that had nothing to do with what they were doing. So when you looked at their income statement, they were losing money. But then you shut the division down, what happens? People still eat at Chinese restaurants, and now they charge it to structured products or unstructured products or whatever it is. It just goes somewhere else. It's amazing how much decision making is based on what you see as the proverbial bottom line instead of focusing on what's incremental. Okay. Question?
No, I was just going to say that for tax reporting purposes, you wouldn't want to follow the account.
Absolutely. For taxes, do whatever you need to do to show them that you make no money ever. I'm on your side 100% of the time. Right? This has nothing to do. So the decision making...
Be careful, don't be too arrogant. Yeah. Be a little.
Well, I'm not the tax guy. If you can get away with it, do it, right? So that's a different question. Which brings us to the final piece of the puzzle. So I've gone from earnings to cash flows to incremental cash flows. I need to time weight them. This is a fancy way of saying I need to discount them. And to discount them, what do you need? A discount rate. Do I have one for the theme park? The 8.46%. And there's one loose end to tie up. There are two ways I can make this time-weighted number a return. The first is I can take every cash flow and discount it back to today and add up the present values, in which case I get a net present value for the project, and the rule is very simple. If that net present value is positive, I'll take the project. If it's negative, I should reject it, even if it's only $5. See, but it's a big project. Why is the net present value of $5 sufficient? How do you answer somebody who says, why should I take a project with a really small net present value if it's a big project? Why is it still okay? It's over and above your cost of capital. Would I rather make 50 million or 500 million or 5 billion? Of course, but beggars can't be choosers. If the only thing you can do is take a project with a $15 net present value, take it. So it's a very simple decision rule. Come up with a net present value greater than zero, take it. The alternative is to look for that discount rate that makes your net present value zero. It's called the internal rate of return. And you compare that to your cost of capital, your hurdle rate, you're done. So I'm going to do this on the theme park, but there's one loose end I want to tie up. What did I say happens after year 10? I think it continues, but I never wait to tie it up, right? So I'm going to make an assumption that some of you might disagree with. I'm going to assume the project keeps going after year 10. For how long? Forever. I know that freaks you out. But when I say forever, it buys me this very simple way of bringing in what happens after that. In fact, here's what I'm going to assume. After year 10, the number of tourists coming into the theme park levels off. You see why I had to make that assumption? If I let the number of tourists keep growing, I'm going to have a problem. People come into the theme park, they can't move. So if I grow the number of tourists, I have to invest more, make the theme park bigger. So I've left the theme park at its existing size. But I'm going to assume that Disney is going to be able to grow the revenues at the inflation rate. So in my case, the US dollars is 2%. Yeah?
You're 10 years to start with, isn't that?
That's not going to make a difference. I could have stopped at 5.
Accountants usually depreciate buildings over 30 years or it's never 10
It doesn't
years.
Matter because in a sense, what's happening here is the depreciation I'm putting back into the theme park. You know why I'm doing that? Because what I'm assuming is whatever is coming from depreciation, I've got, so whatever the life you take, it's going to get offset because the money is going to go back because I want to keep the theme park going. So what that allows me to do is use that perpetuity equation, which gives me this immense value of 11 point, you say, what does it even mean? That becomes the cash flow I put in year 10, and it's what I think this theme park will be worth if I sell it to somebody, lock, stock, barrel, and Mickey included. You see why Mickey's got to be there? If I pull my characters out and say, well, how much did you pay for the theme park? People are not going to pay it. So this is almost something that Disney would never do. You can't sell a theme park with your prime characters. So it's a hypothetical. What is it allowing me to do? It's allowing me to capture what happens after year 10. I actually presented this at Disney. And the theme park, the head of theme parks, put up his hand and he says, even theme parks don't last forever. I said, you're right. How long do you think they last? He said, about 50, 60 years. You know what happens if I, instead of using a perpetuity formula, if I used what's called a growing annuity formula, which allows you to have a finite life, and I used a 40-year, if I stopped in year 50, you know what this number would have been? Very close to 11 billion. When we use perpetuity formulas in finance, we're not being these wild-eyed optimists thinking everything lasts forever. It's just a convenience that we use because if you have a really long life, you might as well go with the perpetuity. It's much easier to deal with. So if you made a big deal about this perpetuity, I'd say, okay, tell me the life, I'll put that in. It allows me to capture what happens after year 10. I discount back at the cost of capital. What I get as my net present value for this theme park is 3.3 billion. Ready? You're the decision maker. Good or bad? Yeah. In fact, if you take this theme park, your value as Disney will increase by roughly 3.3 billion. It's actually one of the great things about NPV. NPVs are additive. You take a positive net present value project, your value goes up by that amount. You take a negative net present value project, your value goes down by that amount. You're saying, why would I take a negative net present value project? And that's what an acquisition on which you overpay is. 55% of all acquiring companies see their stock prices drop on the announcement of an acquisition. For better or worse, investors think you just paid too much. They might be wrong. But that's exactly the only, that's the only place I can punish you for taking a bad investment, for overpaying on an acquisition. Yeah?
So maybe the question is the sensitivity of that.
We'll come back to that. No. Because I've made a bunch of assumptions, and I could be wrong in every one of them. So I'm going to come back and say, how do we deal with that? Incidentally, if you don't like the NPV,
yeah,
I can give it to you as a percentage rate of return. It's not a big deal. The NPV, the IRR is that discount rate that makes the net present value zero. In this case, it's 12.6%, which is higher than my 8.45% cost of capital I estimated for them. So both the NPV and the IRR give me the same signal. The project is a good project. So what do you think tipped the scale? Because on an accounting return basis, this project did not look that good. It's bringing in what happens after year 10 that's tipped the scale. Okay? Now let's ask some follow-up questions. I did everything in dollars, right? Why? Because you felt more comfortable making dollars decisions on a dollar basis. If I'd done everything in nominal reais, you think I'd have got the same answer?
Yes.
Let's try this. It's easy enough to do, right? To convert dollars into reais, I need an expected exchange rate. And when I did this in 2009, I remember hearing, or 2013, I remember hearing from my Brazilian friends about how pessimistic these numbers look like. There was no way the RIA would lose. Because what have I done? I've essentially taken the difference in inflation and I projected out how much the RIA is going to depreciate. Basically, it's purchasing power parity. I'm depreciating. He's saying that's so old-fashioned. It actually works in the long term. It acts like a magnet. You can put this off for a decade. But essentially, based on my estimates, by the time I get to year 10, it's going to take 4.56 RIA to buy a dollar. The only thing I didn't expect would happen in year 2, not in year 10. Okay? That was out of my control. So my cash flows are going to be based on those expected exchange rates. Now that my cash flows have become RIA cash flows, I need a RIA cost of capital, which we've talked about how to make that adjustment. You discount the RIA cash flows at the RIA cost of capital. The net present value that I got in RIA terms was 7.745 billion RIAs. Converted back at the exchange rate that day, I get exactly the same net present value to the nth decimal point. But it's happening here because I'm being consistent about inflation. And that's what kills people when they work with different currencies. Is when you allow different inflation assumptions to feed through your cash flows and your discount rate, you are asking for trouble. Strange things are going to happen. So try to preserve that consistency because that's what allows me to get the same value. Now let's talk about what Thiago brought up. Am I uncertain about all my numbers? Unless I have a remarkably big ego, the answer is absolutely. I could be wrong about the tax rate, the revenue, the cost, every single item should be wrong. So let me ask you a question. This is not an atypical problem. Many of you, if you value companies or you do project analysis, at the end of the process, you're going to look at your numbers and say, oh my God, I could be really wrong. It's a lot. So I'm going to ask you what your response is to uncertainty. First is, you could wait for the uncertainty to resolve itself. In which case, how long are you going to be waiting? Forever. There's something around. Maybe you're one of those people who says, if there's uncertainty, I will not take the investment. There are people who do that. In which case, what are you going to end up with? A company that's all cash all the time. You can be one of those people who can actually not phased by uncertainty at all. You know one of the features that great gamblers and great traders share in common? They actually have a part of their brain that actually is the emotional part, it's gone. It's the same thing that psychopaths also have. Psychopaths are actually very good traders. Incidentally, some of them, so maybe you can tame this and make yourself a great trader, but it's a, so maybe you're one of those people who's not fazed by uncertainty. I'm not lucky enough to be a psychopath. I am. I mean, when I do a valuation, every time I value a company, look at them and say, oh my God, I could be wrong here. So, I'm going to give you a couple of ways in which you can deal with the uncertainty. One is this, why are you so worried? It's a big investment, right? You have $5 billion. So one of the reasons you're worried about being wrong is if you screw up, there's a lot of... So one simplistic way, this has been around for as long as project analysis has been around, is you can ask, how many years does it take me to get my initial... Because once you get your $5 billion back, at least you can sit back and relax a little bit. So what I do is I add up the cash flows to see when I get my money back. It's called payback. And if you can make your money back in less years rather than more, you'll go for it. In this case, it turns out that my payback is about 10 years on this theme park. Now, how do I use it? Some companies actually have payback restrictions. They will not take projects if the payback is more than X years. In fact, if I want to make my money back with that required return, it takes 17 years to get my money back. Very simplistic, but often...
The required return means the hurdle rate?
That's your cost of capital. Right. So basically the 8.46% a year.
That is actually the right cost.
There's no right here. This is about making yourself feel better about uncertainty, right? You've already done the project and as the net present value is positive. You know it's a good project. This is really about, am I okay with the fact that I have to wait 17 years to see my cash flows back with the return? Okay. The second way you can deal with uncertainty is you can start asking what if questions. I'll tell you something, it's going to sound very strange. It's become too easy to ask what-if questions. Does that sound weird? I did my MBA in 1979 through 81. So in summer of 1980, I was looking for a job. You know how difficult it was to get it? This was one of the worst recessions in US history. I ended up with a job at a company called Watermark. company none of you would have heard of. But it actually, what it did was it produced radio shows that it syndicated to TVs, to radio stations. So basically, it sold radio, so the radio station. In fact, the show they produced is still on the air. Some of you might have heard. It's called American Top 40. If you drive any part of the U.S. on a Sunday, you got the radio on. It's an incredibly creative concept. Here's what it does. It starts with, takes the songs from the previous week and starts with number 40, number 39, number 38, so it plays down to number one, with all little storytelling in the middle. It's a four-hour show. They sold it to 500 stations each week. You got $1,000 from each station each week, so it's a nice lucrative business. $500,000 a week, 52 weeks a year. They hired me because they wanted to take a second show called Soundtrack of the 60s. Here's what they were going to do. Remember, this is 1980. They went to the same week in 1960. And what do you think they did then? They took the top 40 songs in that week and played them down. So they hired me and said, we'd like to decide whether to take the show. Can you do the capital budgeting? I remember the first day I walked in. I walked to the CFO's cubicle. It was such a small company. Even the CFO didn't have an office. He had a cubicle. And I said, can you give me the cash flows on this project? Because every problem I'd ever seen in a corporate finance class came with cash flows. He handed me a blank ledger sheet. Have you guys ever seen a ledger sheet? It's a big sheet with lots of columns. He said, that's your job. That's why we hired you. I looked and said, what do I do? I mean, what have I gotten myself into? So I decided I wanted to build this up. So first job is I have to figure out how many stations you can sell the new show to. I hung out around outside the marketing guy's cubicle for like 3 days. He hated me because I was a numbers person. He's a creative guy. So he acted like I wasn't there. Finally, on the third day, I said, look, I need a number to get started. He said, I don't know, 200, 300, 400, something like that. So I knew this was the best I was going to get out of him. So guess how I got my spreadsheet started? Base case, 300 stations. Built the entire spreadsheet on 300. Line item, it took me 6 weeks. I finally had the cash flow. I got a net present value. I told the CEO, I have your numbers. I've got, hired me to do the analysis. I'm ready to do. So we get around a coffee table, the CEO, two directors and me, and I present the numbers. And I hit them at the climactic finding. I say, based on your cash flows, the net present value is negative, and you shouldn't make this new show. They all looked at each other and said, what would happen if you tried 400 stations? This is an Excel spreadsheet. Remember, this is a ledger sheet. Each number I've done by hand. If you take 300 to 400, that's like 3 days of work. I said, why do you want to do this? And they said, if you tried 400, the show would look good, right? I said, probably. They said, try 400. I said, why? They said, we've already decided to do the show. We just want you to confirm it for us. I thought at that moment it was because they were a small business and not being scientific that they did. I have some really bad news. This is the way the world works. People decide to do something, then your job is to grind out the numbers to make sure that their rear end is covered no matter what happens. Look, I have the analysis there. The Time Warner, that deal really made sense. But asking what if questions in those days was restrictive because you couldn't ask that many questions. Today, it's become easy, right? In fact, every spring when I teach this class, I make up a case. Last 2 years ago, for instance, was the Apple iCar. I make up stuff about this project, and I say, and it's 400 people broken up into groups of five, and then they each look at these facts, and they have a singular mission. They have to tell me whether Apple should invest in the iCar. And they can use whatever techniques they want, and I pray. I beg them, please don't make this too long, because I've got to read 80 of these reports. Usually they listen. But every spring when I offer this out, there's always one outlier. So most of them will come in 9 pages, 10 pages. The outlier will be 110 pages. So what the heck did these guys do? A couple of years ago, the iCard, this group had run 105 different scenarios. They must have written a macro that basically ran scenarios while they were sleeping. Scenarios like, what happens if Janet Yellen catches a cold? Work through the numbers. Net present value is this number. But here's the problem they ran into. The end of the 105 scenarios, in 55 of the scenarios, they ended up with a positive net present value. In 50, they ended up with a negative net present value. So here's how they summarized their findings. They said, if you know you're going to be in a positive scenario, take the project. if you believe you're going to be in a negative scenario, don't take the profit. I said, this is such wonderful advice. But in a sense, you can see what happened, right? You get so caught up in what-if analyses that at the end of the process, you've forgotten what the end game here is. The end game is not to churn out more and more exhibits. It's to make a better decision. And I really think Excel, I mean, there's actually a book that was written called PowerPoint Makes You Stupid, which should terrify you after 2 days of PowerPoint slide after PowerPoint slide. But Excel also makes you really not that creative, right? Insert chart. It's right there. Click. Chart. To compare two numbers. I don't need a chart. Just give me the two numbers. But you have two big bars next to each other. So I have a reading suggestion for you. It's a book written by a guy called Tufte, T-U-F-T. You don't have to do it by tomorrow. This is something for the long term. Okay? A guy called Edward Tufte. You heard of him? His area is how to present information visually. In fact, one of his most famous books is called The Visual Display of Information. And in it is my favorite graph of all time.
What is the book's name?
Okay. The Visual Display of Information. Author is Tufte, T-U-F-T-E. So go into Amazon, you'll find it. It's $10, a paperback. This is actually the story of Napoleon's ill-fated expedition to invade Russia a couple of hundred years ago. I don't know what this fixation with Russia that European monarchs have. It's big, it's out there, I guess. So someday in 1803 or 4, Napoleon wakes up one day and says, I'd like to invade Russia. So big army gathers together. There's the big army leaving Paris. That's so the width of the line is how big the army is. And they're marching across. He's saying, what are these tangents? They get distracted. They invade Poland along the way, it's always there. So basically that's all they say. So this is the army marching across Europe, and then it's getting into Russia, and it's getting later and later in the year. Going in. So there they get to the outskirts of Moscow. If you've ever been in Moscow, there's actually that gate that, you know, this big stone, you know, archway. And it's December 12th. And, you know what, you don't want to be in Moscow on December 12th. And Napoleon says, it's cold, I want to go home. So there's the army turning around this dark line, and it's marching back. And on this axis is the temperature dropping as they march back. So guess what? The army, so by the time it ends back up in Paris, it's three guys carrying Napoleon home. This is a great graph. It captures the entire story and was drawn by hand. All you have to do is tell me what will happen to the net present value if your margin changes. You have a much lesser mission. Let's do it more creatively. So I'm going to leave you with one final point. Have you ever heard of a Monte Carlo simulation? This is not in your quiz, so don't be worrying about this. I'm not going to. You know what a Monte Carlo simulation allows you to do? Remember what Thiago asked me about the estimates, my revenue, my growth, that these numbers could be wrong? In a Monte Carlo simulation, rather than hide from uncertainty, you face up to it. What does that mean? Instead of making one number as my revenue, I give you a distribution. So I say your revenues can be this number, but they could be off by 20% either direction. Your costs are 60%, but they could be as low as 45 or as high as 75. So with each number, I give you a distribution. In a simulation, what the computer does, it goes picks one outcome out of each distribution and computes the net present value. And in a typical simulation, and I use Crystal Ball, which is an add-on to Excel to do it, you run 100,000 simulations. Each time you get a different net present value. And here's what the output looks like. Rather than give you one net present value, I give you a distribution of net. You say, what does this even tell me? The median value across the simulations is very close to what we got with the base case. So that should be no surprise. But what is the deal worried about? That this project could be a bad project, right? I can tell you what the probability of that happening is. All I have to do is count the net present values less than zero. There's about a 10% chance this project is a bad project. Best case, right there. Worst case, right here. Everything's in there. 30 years ago, to run a Monte Carlo simulation would have cost you tens of thousands of dollars and required a mainframe computer. Today, you have a few hundred dollars. You buy Crystal Ball. You add it onto Excel. Off to the races. I use simulations in my valuations all the time. When I feel most uncertain, This is my way of getting comfortable with the uncertainties I face up to that. I am uncertain. Why am I hiding from that? I'm valuing Twitter. Of course I'm going to be wrong. Might as well see how wrong I could be. That's the advantage you get with the simulation. All tools and techniques designed to make